Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. As President Obama somewhat famously said when he was first elected in 2008, elections have consequences. Today, we continue the Midday conversation about what the consequences of Donald Trump's convincing victory might be. We started this conversation yesterday. We won't finish it today, but we will think a little bit about what the ramifications for the political process are as the Obama-Trump transition begins. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland and Michael Fletcher from ESPN's The Undefeated join me to weigh in on the election that has left half of our country fiercely ecstatic and the other half stunned. You are an important part of this conversation. Join us for Midday after these headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you are along for the ride. So what does the election of Donald Trump tell us about our country's apparent embrace of unprecedented change? And what does it tell us about what Americans are repudiating? Is Trump's upset a repudiation of civility in politics? Is it an embrace of isolationism and a rejection of religious and racial tolerance? Is it, as Mr. Trump suggested early yesterday morning, a cry from those who have been forgotten? Or is it a mean-spirited and fear-fueled affirmation of a system that favors white people over people of color, a system that elevates men over women? Will Mr. Trump heed the oft-repeated plea to lock her up? Are the White House, the Senate, and the Congress, at least putatively, at his disposal to assist in that effort? Or is he essentially a third-party candidate whose repudiation of politics as usual places him at odds with both major political parties, in so much as they represent the establishment? Republican voters certainly flocked to Trump at the polls, and many Republican leaders who had distanced themselves before the election started fawning almost immediately after he was declared the winner. Yesterday, our conversation about the election was cut short so we could bring you President Obama's remarks about the transition of power. He is meeting with President-elect Trump at this hour. Here at Midday, we think it's important that our program serve as a place where everybody, regardless of their political preferences, can share their reactions to important events and issues. So we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday in our truncated conversation about what the election means and the way forward for our country. We're joined by Sherry Parks, an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, where she's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Sherry joins us on the phone from Washington. Welcome back, Sherry.
Hi, thanks.
And Michael Fletcher is with us as well. He's a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated and the co-author of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. He's here in the studio. Mike, good to see you.
Hey, good to be back, Tom.
And I hope you'll join us as well. Let us know how you're feeling and let us know what you're thinking now that the reality of the election is sinking in. All are welcome at this table. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. You want to send us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. So, Sherry, folks who run for exercise, not run for political office, but run for exercise, often refer to the day after, meaning if you run a marathon or a half marathon on Saturday, you feel a little achy on Sunday, but for some reason you feel even achier on Monday. So today we are at the day after the day after. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, but how are you feeling? How are you processing this now 2 days out?
Well, I'm not sure all the lactic acid is out of my muscles at this point, but I think the initial emotion that I had has begun not to wane, but to work through it and to begin to think my way through it, which is often the way I try to handle negative emotion. So I'm feeling, you know, I've watched the protests. I've had some conversations, including one with somebody who voted for Trump. And I'm beginning to think my way through it.
And that conversation with the Trump voter, how'd that go?
Well, it was interesting. They were worried about me because they saw that I was sad. And it was interesting. And I'm sure we will do this during this hour, to kind of dig into that 50%, because there are groups within that group. And we've been focusing on the extremists, the people who are retweeting the racist and misogynist and homophobic statements. She did not believe that he would, one, be able to do all the things that he said he was going to do, and two, she didn't agree with it, and she actually is counting on a certain amount of inertia by the bureaucracy and the government. She wanted to shake things up. And I actually referred, if those of you who were listening yesterday, to the last caller to the show, who you asked, well, what do you expect to change? And he didn't have an answer. And she thought that that was very interesting and said that, yes, she thought she just wanted to shake things up because she thought government was corrupt. But she knew that there was not much direction to what would happen after the shaking.
Yeah, and Mike Fletcher, the Washington Post, reporting today, for example, in Wisconsin, 61% of Wisconsin voters viewed Mr. Trump unfavorably, but 1 in 5, 20% of that group, voted for him anyway. So, I mean, the expectations, the bar has been lowered about as low as it can go.
Exactly. I think Sherry hit on the thing that's happening here. People want change, and it's many of the things that we would look on normally at any normal political candidate and say, well, these are liabilities, became, I think, assets for Donald Trump. Every time he broke convention and broke with norms and broke with even our expectations for language and decorum for a candidate, I think that built his trove of authenticity to people and the idea that he'll come to Washington and do something. And again, I mean, that's the big question. What do people really want him to do? I don't think you would get a
coherent. That's pretty amorphous, isn't it?
Right, very much so. And if you think about it, what he promised has always shifted a lot. He basically offers himself as a deal maker, someone who can make things happen. But even his most sort of the things we remember most about the campaign, like build the wall, you know, he's backed off a little bit on some of that rhetoric. Deporting illegal immigrants. He's softened it around the edges. So it's hard to tell what we could expect, which makes it all the more surreal in a sense. People want change. They don't know where they want us to land. And frankly, it's a little unsettling.
Yeah, it is unsettling to be sure. I mean, this cynicism in government, Sherry Park, seems to me that started back with Reagan, you know, who was saying in the 1980s that government essentially is the enemy. It's on your back. It's an albatross that we need to somehow, you know, unfetter ourselves from. And this cynicism, we've been told about the evils of government and the pointy-headed bureaucrats, et cetera, that message is sinking in. Perhaps Trump is the logical conclusion to this constant barrage of anti-government rhetoric over literally decades.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because where I am is, I mean, they're having lunch and I'm talking to you, but I'm at a conference on nonviolence. And some of the discussion has been that Trump is really the figure that has represented American values as they stand now, of a certain selfishness, of a certain bullying and a lack of association with the truth. And that's been really interesting to watch. The people who heard what he had to say and did not assume that he was speaking his own truth.
Did not assume he was speaking his own truth.
Well, you know, if there's a conflict, there's a paradox. They're saying he's authentic, and yet they don't quite believe that he believes the words that are coming out of his own mouth. You see the conflict?
Yeah, and they're willing to buy in anyway. Yeah.
Well, and human beings are perfectly capable of carrying paradox and contradiction. It's just a little unsettling, as Michael said, in a leader.
Mike Fletcher, Hillary Clinton has apparently won the popular vote. Mm-hmm. They're still counting a few votes. There are a few states that still haven't been called. I mean, Arizona and Michigan have mm-hmm. not yet been called. They're very close. New Hampshire, very close. Right now, Secretary Clinton leads Mr. Trump by just 1,400 votes. The Libertarian vote in New Hampshire, for example, mm-hmm. Gary Johnson got 30,000 right. votes. So who knows how many of those, you know, would have gone to Trump or how many of those would have gone to Clinton. But does the, you know, they were very small percentages in every state for Johnson and Stein. But what's your take on the impact of these third-party candidates in some of these races that were close, places like Florida, places like North Carolina?
It's really hard to know because, as you point out, we don't know if we subtracted them from the race, which way those votes would have gone or whether those voters would have voted at all. So it's just one of those imponderables. We just don't know what the impact is. I know it has to be frustrating to Hillary Clinton to lose, sort of so closely in these key states. But going forward, my theory is it's not going to matter. I think Trump is going to act like a president with a mandate. And if he doesn't have a mandate, he certainly has a Congress and he has a Supreme Court appointment. So he's going to move forward, I think, as if he had gotten, 55% of the vote, and there's going to really be nothing to really stop him other than the sensibilities of Republican leaders in Congress. So, and we saw that with George W. Bush to some degree. When he's elected, he had lost the popular vote, but he operated as a strong president.
Yeah, mandates are in the eyes of the beholder, right. I guess. Here's what part of what President-elect Trump had to say on election night, or I should say early the next morning.
Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
So, Sherry Parks, as some of the exit polling and some of the data starts trickling in from Tuesday's election, The Washington Post writes in today's paper about the fact that 6 in 10 Americans do not have a college degree, and they elected Donald Trump. So one of the divides we have is between people with higher education and people without. The Post says that this is an indictment of the monolithic, insulated political culture in the vast majority of our colleges and universities. You have a little experience in colleges and universities.
Yeah, I do.
What do you think?
Well, actually, it's interesting because if you go back and look at the history and what the Founding Fathers meant, they wrote that they did not intend for most of us to vote. I mean, certainly their laws were set up for that white men of property. But underneath that was a philosophy that you had to have an educated citizenry in order to have a democracy. Now, that does not mean a college education. I'm not one of those college professors who thinks that everybody needs to have a college education. But where I place the blame is that we have not created the apparatus to educate the citizenry and able to make them able to vote. If you go looking for, my 21-year-old daughter was voting. She was trying to be very responsible, and she was trying to get, for instance, information on the local and state ordinances in Maryland because she was doing by absentee, and I had to help her find it.
Hard to come by. It was
hard to come by. So my point is that we have not set up the structure that allows people to vote in ways other than by emotion.
Well, but it wasn't very hard to come by the positions and the personal character of Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald John Trump.
Well, see, I would disagree. I think it was easy to find Hillary Clinton's. If you were listening to public radio today, and in particular the BBC, the diplomatic community around the world is still trying to figure out what Donald Trump meant because his policies were not fully meshed out. They don't know.
Yeah, and he is a mystery to a lot of people. He is meeting with the president as we speak, with President Obama, and beginning that transition. Before we take a break, let's try to grab one phone call. John from Bell Camp, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks and Michael Fletcher.
Hey, good to talk to you again. I tossed and turned all night, like a lot of other people did probably this morning, probably woke up at 3:30 this morning thinking about this. Not my politics, which we're going to see over the next 4 years, but what I'm more disturbed about than anything else is it feels to me that America has turned its back and seen the death of integrity as a value in this country. When people are willing to overlook the personal, the moral, the ethical shortcomings of this man who will seemingly say whatever a given crowd wants to hear, whether it's true or not, knowing that so much has been untrue or impossible to deliver on, and voting for that person anyway because there seems to be a payoff, you know, monetary payoff, basically, an economic payoff, overlooking all the other stuff. I think it's dangerous for this country.
Well, John,
and I think it signals something intrinsic that has certainly gone wrong for all of us.
Well, John, you know, the charge that a candidate would say anything to get elected is a charge that Trump voters would levy and have levied just as vehemently against Secretary Clinton. So what do you say to the
Trump? The topic here is Donald Trump and his ethical exceptions.
And, of course, you know, it was Secretary Clinton's perceived ethical exceptions that were a big factor in motivating people to perhaps overlook, as you say, some of the shortcomings of Mr. Trump. So it's a complicated web. But I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling midday. We will be back in just a second. We're going to take a little break. Sherry Parks joins us on the phone from D.C. She's an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, College Park. Michael Fletcher is with me here in the studio. He's a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're here. A little later today, we're going to touch base with our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. She'll share her thoughts about the new show at the Everyman Theater. It's called The Roommate. And coming up tomorrow, a conversation about prison reform, and in particular, changing the pervasiveness of isolating incarcerated people, with the author of a new book called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. That's coming up on Midday Friday. If you're just joining us today, Michael Fletcher of The Undefeated and Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland join us to talk a bit more about the election. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We have an email from Caroline in Baltimore, who writes, I have a few Republican friends. I've been asking them over the past couple of days to tell me why they think that I shouldn't be afraid of what is coming. They say that they don't think Mr. Trump meant the things he said about disabled people, gay people, women, Muslims, that he's not socially conservative and he will not do harm to these people. I wonder how many Trump voters are like this, and will they be proven right or wrong in their presumption that their candidate was lying about his attitude on social issues. So, Sherry Park, this is really unprecedented in American politics, that people are just sort of assuming that what the politician is saying isn't true and looking past that and voting for him.
And, I mean, actually, that's what John was, I think, beginning to talk about, that the death of integrity, that some people assume that Donald Trump doesn't mean what he says, that the words that come out of his mouth. And then we don't have anything to go on. And what we do know, though, is that people who voted for him were angry, and that people who didn't vote for him were, and she just used the word, were afraid. So anger and fear are the things that are driving, rather than ideas or, as we said, policy. And that is, I think, and actually this isn't original to me, related to our commercial culture, where you know that this product won't do everything it says, but you use it anyway. Now that we sell presidents the way we sell other commodities, I think there's been a washover of that effect.
That's interesting, Mike Fletcher, the commodification of politics and the branding of politicians. 29% of Latinos voted for Mr. Trump, and that's actually a higher percentage of those who voted for Mitt Romney.
Exactly, and I think that confounds and complicates any analysis we try to do of kind of the Trump coalition. Yeah, granted, the heart of that coalition was kind of working class whites and rural and exurban whites. That was the heart. But around the edges, as you point out, 29% of Latino voters, who would have guessed that? You would assume.
In fact, the Clinton campaign seemed to assume that it would be much, much less.
Yes,
and that
exactly.
They would get a more overwhelming percentage. Of
exactly. And I think they were justified to expect that, given Trump's rhetoric through the campaign. So apparently this idea of taking what he says as metaphor, you know, extends beyond, you know, working class whites. I read that 13% of black males voted for him. Now, I don't know how precise these exit polls get and what that margin of error is, but if that's anywhere near accurate, that's astounding.
Yeah, and it's overall about 8% African-Americans.
Yeah, right, which pretty much brings him back to, you know, to normal Republican standards, because the black vote for Republicans was so depressed when Obama was on the ticket. So this, you know, this says something. I think people, and maybe it says something about, I think it says a lot about our culture and a lot about our media. People like kind of the truth, quote unquote, truth telling that Trump seems to bring to the table, even though no one takes him literally. Yeah. And when the press tries to take him literally, it's almost like everyone rolls their eyes, like, you know, saying, well,
forget fact checking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Well, Sherry Parks, I remember last summer.
Can I say something about Latinos before we move on?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Please.
We have to remember that the term Latinos doesn't mean anything to people that we call Latinos, that nobody comes to the United States as a Latino. What happened, and actually there's a book called Latinos, Inc., The Making and Marketing of a People. People come to the United States as Venezuelans or Mexicans or Colombians, and then we have tried to treat them the way we have treated African Americans, as one big galvanized group. And it doesn't hang together. That was a particularly naive assumption by the Clinton administration, that they would hang together as a voting bloc. Because if you dig into it, and you mentioned it yesterday, if you understand the way Cubans have voted, you would pull away from that. And if you look at the way first-generation versus second-generation immigrants who turn around and have said, well, I got in, but I don't know about those people, you might have known that that group wouldn't have hung together as a voting bloc.
Yeah, it's nuanced. It's complex, that's for sure. Julie in Columbia, welcome to Midday with Mike Fletcher and Sherry Parks. Glad you called.
Hello.
Hi, Julie. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, Julie. I can't hear you, or maybe you can't hear me, but we'll try to get back to you. Let's go to Joseph in Germantown. Joseph, welcome to Midday. Joseph, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Joseph. You're on Midday. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. This is Johnson from Germantown. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted people to realize that this election was not normal. When we are talking about the election, we should bear in mind that everybody that did the posters and the conclusions, they were right, but the election was stolen. So in the sense that it was pre-planned that they would do things that would throw Clinton away when he was on his way to get the election, So one example is the Comey. The timing of Comey announcement was pre-planned. All the his people and the Giuliani.
But Joseph, think about this, Joseph. What you're suggesting is that there's a large conspiracy that involved Mr. Comey and others outside of the FBI to time an announcement.
And
I mean, there's no evidence of that, sir.
Voted Clinton, and it came out as Trump. And they reported this to the election officers, and they said they were going to take care of it. All those battleground states were focused for computer problems.
Okay,
so
well,
it's
Joseph,
not that Clinton did not do his part or her part, but the election was designed to be rigged from the beginning.
Okay, of course, that's a complaint, Joseph, that we heard about from Mr. Trump himself, which is an interesting notion that for the first time in my recollection of an election, both sides claiming that it was rigged. Sherry Parks, what do you make of the fact that Russia was reported today to have been in contact? A diplomat from the Russian government admitted to having contact with the Trump campaign during the campaign. Of course, we know about Russia's, or we have a high assumption about Russia's involvement in the WikiLeaks leaks of emails sent to and from John Podesta. This is a huge story, it seems to me.
Well, and it's interesting because the connection between WikiLeaks and the Russians is one that we really need to dig into as a country, as journalists use WikiLeaks and don't question what gets released and what doesn't get released. The Russians have been pretty upfront about In covert ways, maybe, but certainly in overt ways, and their support for Donald Trump. And they fully expect there to be, the word that was used this morning, a warming of U.S.-Russian relationships, and that that might have an impact on what goes on in Syria. That is, I think, something that is profoundly different. And I want to circle back to what Joseph was saying, not so much the content of what we were saying, but the suspicion, the idea that now we are highly suspicious of the government in ways that we haven't seen in this country. And the story about the Russians, I think, contributes to that.
And, Mike Fletcher, we're also highly suspicious of the media.
Yeah, we are both. I mean, just to focus on government for a second, I think you put your finger on it earlier in the show, with starting with Reagan. You know, it was like the government's bad, the government's corrupt. You know, this has been a drumbeat now for, you know, for more than a generation. And when people say, even when they say Washington is corrupt, I don't think people know exactly what they mean by that, but it's something that people nod their heads to in agreement. And the same with the media. People assume that stories are planted, and clearly the media has become, you know, sort of factionalized now. It's almost like the old days of newspapers where, you know, media was affiliated with political parties in some cases, particularly on, you know, Fox News is the greatest example of that. But so now you don't have this kind of like objective truth anymore. Everyone has their own version of the truth, and that contributes to kind of a chaos that's out here when it comes to information. You can fact check Donald Trump, you know, until the cows come home, and only half of the people will believe the fact check because the other half will believe that it's, you know, that it's some kind of plant or, you know, somehow unfair. So, you know, where do you go with that? That's going to be interesting to see going forward. But, you know, I just also wanted to throw a question out there. You know, we sort of questioned the electorate and we're kind of in this crazy place now. But it was just 8 years ago that we were, like, praising this country for sort of breaking through old prejudices and seeing beyond themselves and all of that. And you know, President Obama's election was to some degree powered by some of these same counties, the white working class, that now has backed Donald Trump. So I hesitate to draw very, you know, sharp conclusions about this.
John, speaking of the electorate, John sent me an email yesterday quoting H.L. Mencken from 1920. Mencken wrote, "As democracy is perfected, the office of president represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be adorned by a downright moron." So this is what the Mencken quote that John was put in mind of after this last election. Sherry Parks, were we making just fundamentally wrong assumptions? And when I say we, I'm talking about the media, who really thought forcefully that Hillary Clinton was going to win this election. I mean, all the polls, all the numbers, all the indications were that Trump's support was going to ceiling out and it just wasn't going to be enough. Were we making fundamentally wrong assumptions about who we are as a citizenry?
Well, I hope that after the media moves on to from how did we get this so wrong, there is a real self-analysis about their role in a democracy. Because, yeah, they missed this one. That they were taking – let me back up a little bit. Now that the media have to turn a profit, because that wasn't always the case. It was a very conservative business until the Reagan administration. They were turned into true for-profit businesses in a way that had to be much more aggressive. There's cost savings, and so we have reporters who are often no longer specialists. And now there's an over-reliance on polls. There are social scientists who say, well, polls were never really meant to predict behavior. They're too sloppy. The margin of error is something that would never – we were talking about universities. We would never use that 4% margin of error. That's just sloppy. And so – but we – it's the only thing that reporters are using often because that's the easiest way, the quickest way now that cable is driving the news cycle. They have to do fast. And so we just don't have the level of knowledge. And to go back to that, people do not have the information. We do not have the level of knowledge to fully participate. And the people who, unless universities do them, and we were talking about that a minute ago, the people whose job it is to do that is the mass media.
I don't know. I think maybe when it comes to some obscure ballot questions, people may have a hard time getting information. But in this case, I think particularly the old line newspapers did a great job covering the election.
Think about David Fahrenthold and
charitable giving, and also all the scandals we heard about Trump University. You know, whatever we think of WikiLeaks, it brought us inside, maybe in a very selective way, inside the Clinton campaign, and people can make sense of or not of these emails and kind of what they added up to. So I think there was information out there. I really think the action of media did a really good job in presenting information, but I think people just choose to believe what they want to believe, and people tune in to the media outlets that, you know, we've heard this many times over the years, you know, that kind of confirm their basis notions. And I think I think it's a kind of more complex problem, because I think the information is out there, and the press, in my view, did a pretty good job. I don't think it's just a bunch of reporters sitting back regurgitating polls. There's some of that. There's probably too much of that, but there was much more going on as well.
I agree with you that people tend to attend to what they want to attend, but I think that information that you're talking about came way too late. It should have been out there a year and a half ago.
It was out there for many months. Yeah.
Interesting. Let's hear a little bit of what Secretary Clinton had to say in her concession speech yesterday morning.
And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
I want to go to Julie again in Columbia. Julie, let's try this again. You're on Midday. Welcome to the show.
Okay, I'm sorry. I had you on speaker before. Okay, this is what keeps me awake at night. Trump hurts women the most of everyone in the United States. He models assault on women, and Pence and Cruz want their religion imposed on everyone of when life begins. Pence has killed women in his own state by making it illegal for doctors to do abortions there. He wants a law requiring funerals for miscarried fetuses. Trump says he will appoint Supreme Court justices who will make abortion illegal. It will be illegal for rape victims, for women with ectopic pregnancies, for women who can't feed and care for a child to have an abortion.
Okay, so Julie, he's been elected President of the United States, and Mr. Pence has been elected Vice President of the United States. There were a number of protests happening around the country yesterday, people chanting, "He's not my president." Is he not your president? And if so, what does that mean to you?
Can I just finish? I just have one more sentence. Then they make laws that do away with food for the babies, that they force the women to have for health care for them, and they do not provide education for the babies of those babies that they're being born. In short, we have a president who assaults women and a vice president who kills them, and soon a Supreme Court that kills women.
Okay, Julie, well, thank you for your call. Sherry Parks, the women's issue, as it were, again, seems to be another example of a lot of women, at least, overlooking Mr. Trump's comments to Billy Bush what appears to be a pretty long history of being sexually aggressive and assaulting women. Because that's a comment on his moral standing, his moral character and his temperament to be in office. Is that a different kind of thing than his, you know, position on trade or his position on immigration?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that runs through all of those is a certain lack of empathy. And of course, his friends and supporters are saying, but he is empathetic, and we wait to see that. It's interesting how the issue of women is being sublimated in the national conversation when it's so important and they're more than half of the population. I think it's easier to wrap our brains around race and trade and social class. But the comments that about women in terms of sexual assault and about abortion really haven't been played out as fully as we might. And I think Julie's points are really important. And I think it's in part because we still are not quite sure about the role of women. And to circle back, and I think the votes of black men are really about gender, too. We still haven't figured out as a country how to treat women as equals.
You know, what's been interesting is if you look at the exit poll data is white women voted for Trump, right? You know, there was a slight majority. I think women overall went for Clinton by about 12 percentage points, and it was kind of the same gender gap. It was a reverse gender gap to the male vote. But you would expect, and I think, again, I think the media did the job. The Billy Bush stuff was talked about ad nauseum. Women came forward one after another to allege essentially sexual assault against Donald Trump. But it was almost like a form of jury nullification. Some people just chose to ignore that for whatever reason. And maybe they saw mitigating circumstances, or they saw attributes in Trump that they thought would eclipse these deficits.
Let's try to grab one more phone call before we have to take a break. Nick in Baltimore, thanks for calling Midday. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How's it going, guys? I appreciate you guys having this panel discussion today. I just wanted to voice some of my concern about one of the comments that I had heard earlier about how the Democratic Party had not accounted for the amount of Hispanic voters. To me, this is really exemplary of how some of these liberal social justice movements that had been occurring throughout the years were advocating for people of color. And really, they don't understand the real-life issues that some people have. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, Sherry Parks, do you think the Democrats have ignored the Hispanic community in a way that many people in the African-American community think that they're ignored except every 4 years when their votes are needed?
Well, it's interesting because part of the organization that is now being rallied in anti-Trump was already in development to criticize Hillary for neoliberalism, which, of course, speaks about diversity but leaves the power structure in place. And that's actually what Nick is talking about, that often in neoliberalism, the elite, what we'll call the elite for now in shorthand, work to speak for other people instead of with other people. And certainly whenever you talk about Latinos as one galvanized group, that's what you're doing.
Mike Fletcher, a quick final thought. We got to run, take a break.
Well, you know, I think the thing about Latinos is, it's a good point. Obviously, they're not monolithic, and they're from different ethnicities, different countries, different nationalities, rather. But it's kind of the shorthand we've used, and it's kind of played, one way or another in the past. So I think it's still a surprising outcome see Trump do that well.
And it will be interesting because, as you say, so many people, when it comes to the media, they hear the facts. They either choose to assume the media is wrong, mm-hmm. or they choose to ignore, overlook those facts. It'll be interesting to see what happens if the media is able to restore its credibility so that people are no longer just assuming that what they're reading or hearing on television is incorrect. Well, Sherry Parks, Mike Fletcher, thank you both. I appreciate it, and we shall talk to you again soon. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Sherry Parks is an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, College Park. She's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies and the author of a terrific book, Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman, and a regular contributor here on Midday. Michael Fletcher is a former writer for the Washington Post. He's now a senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated and the co-author of another terrific book, Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. More coming up. Stick around.